6. Ideas for Action. Building safety isn't the kind of skill you can learn in a robotic, paint-by-numbers sort of way. It's a fluid, improvisational skill, sort of like learning to pass a soccer ball to a teammate during a game. It requires you to recognize patterns, react quickly, and deliver the right signal at the right time. And like any skill, it comes with a learning curve. This learning curve applies even to the scientists who study belonging. For example, Will Phelps, who did the bad apple study, per chapter 1, described how insights from his research affected the way he communicated in his personal life. "I used to like to try to make a lot of small, clever remarks in conversation, trying to be funny, sometimes in a cutting way," he says. "Now I see how negatively those signals can impact the group. So I try to show that I'm listening. When they're talking, I'm looking at their face, nodding, saying, 'What do you mean by that? Could you tell me more about this?' Or asking their opinions about what we should do, drawing people out." Amy Edmondson, whom we also met in Chapter 1, has studied psychological safety in a wide variety of workplaces. "I used to not think about whether I was making people safe at all," she says. "Now I think about it all the time, especially at the beginning of any interaction. And then I constantly check, especially if there's any change or tension. I bend over backward to make sure people are safe." Phelps and Edmondson are speaking to the same truth. Creating safety is about dialing into small, subtle moments and delivering targeted signals at key points. The goal of this chapter is to provide a few tips on doing that. Over-communicate your listening. When I visited the successful cultures, I kept seeing the same expression on the faces of listeners. It looked like this: head tilted slightly forward, eyes unblinking, and eyebrows arched up. Their bodies were still, and they leaned toward the speaker with intent. The only sound they made was a steady stream of affirmations. "Yes, uh-huh, gotcha," that encouraged the speaker to keep going, to give them more. "Posture and expression are incredibly important," said Ben Weber, a former PhD student of Alex Pentland's, who founded Humanize, a social analytics consulting firm. "It's the way we prove that we're in sync with someone." Relatedly, it's important to avoid interruptions. The smoothness of turn-taking, as we've seen, is a powerful indicator of cohesive group performance. Interruptions shatter the smooth interactions at the core of belonging. They are so discohesive, in fact, that Weber uses interruption metrics as sales training tools. When you can show someone numbers that the top salespeople hardly ever interrupt people, and then rate them on that scale, you can deliver a powerful message, he says. Of course, not all interruptions are negative. Creative sessions, for example, often contain bursts of interruptions. The key is to draw a distinction between interruptions born of mutual excitement and those rooted in lack of awareness and connection. Spotlight your fallibility early on, especially if you're a leader. In any interaction, we have a natural tendency to try to hide our weaknesses and appear competent. If you want to create safety, this is exactly the wrong move. Instead, you should open up, show you make mistakes, and invite input with simple phrases like, "This is just my two cents. Of course I could be wrong here. What am I missing? What do you think?" R.C. Buford, general manager of the San Antonio Spurs, is one of the most successful executives in the history of sports. But if you watch him operate, you might mistake him for an assistant. He's a quiet, affable hound dog Kansan who asks questions, listens keenly, and radiates humility. Early in our conversations, he brought up the looming retirements of several star players and said, "I'm absolutely terrified of the future." He could have talked about the organization's vaunted player selection and development systems, or the progress of the young players, or the smart trades they'd made, or the power of the culture they'd built. But he didn't do that. He said he was terrified. This kind of signal is not just an admission of weakness. It's also an invitation to create a deeper connection, because it sparks a response in the listener. How can I help? To create safety, leaders need to actively invite input, Edmondson says. It's really hard for people to raise their hand and say, I have something tentative to say. And it's equally hard for people not to answer a genuine question from a leader who asks for their opinion or their help. Embrace the messenger. One of the most vital moments for creating safety is when a group shares bad news or gives tough feedback. In these moments, it's important not simply to tolerate the difficult news, but to embrace it. You know the phrase, don't shoot the messenger? Edmondson says. In fact, it's not enough to not shoot them. You have to hug the messenger and let them know how much you need that feedback. That way you can be sure that they feel safe enough to tell you the truth next time. One way to detect belonging levels is by examining the kinds of personal language used in emails. A study by Lin Wu of Wharton looked at 2 years of communication by 8,000 workers and showed that talking about sports, lunch, and coffee predicted whether an employee would be retained better than the revenue they brought in. A study by Amir Goldberg at Stanford showed that it was possible to predict how long employees stayed by how frequently their emails contained family references and swear words. Preview future connection. One habit I saw in successful groups was that of sneak previewing future relationships, making small but telling connections between now and a vision of the future. The St. Louis Cardinals baseball team, for example, is renowned for their culture and their ability to develop young players into big league talent. The Johnson City, Tennessee Cardinals are St. Louis's lowest level minor league club. One day, on a bus belonging to the Tennessee team, one of the Cardinals' coaches, sitting in the front row, gestured up toward the television on which the big league team was playing. You know that pitcher? Players looked up. On the screen, wearing a perfect white uniform, stood the heroic figure of Trevor Rosenthal, a young star who'd become a dominant relief pitcher for the Cardinals. He had pitched in the previous year's World Series. 3 years ago, the coach said, he was sitting right in that seat where you are. That's all he said. It wasn't much. It took about 5 seconds to deliver. But it was powerful because it connected the dots between where the players were and where they were headed. 3 years ago, he was sitting right in that seat where you are. Overdue thank yous. When you enter highly successful cultures, the number of thank yous you hear seems slightly over the top. At the end of each basketball season, for example, Spurs coach Greg Popovich takes each of his star players aside and thanks them for allowing him to coach them. Those are his exact words. Thank you for allowing me to coach you. It makes little logical sense. After all, both Popovich and the player are amply compensated, and it's not like the player had a choice whether to be coached. But this kind of moment happens all the time in highly successful groups, because it has less to do with thanks than affirming the relationship. For example, when I visited Kip Infinity, a remarkable charter school in Harlem, New York, I witnessed teachers thanking one another over and over. The math teachers received T-shirts marking Pi Day as a surprise present from the administrative assistant. Then Jeff Lee, who teaches 8th grade math, sent the following email to the other math teachers in the department. Dear math teachers I love, on assessment number 7, a mid-unit test on linear functions, part of the foundational major work of the grade, the class of 2024 has outperformed the previous two classes on essentially the same test. See below for the data. Class of 2022, 84.5. Class of 2023, 87.2. Class of 2024, 88.7. I know this is a result of better teaching at every grade level from fifth grade on. So thanks for being great teachers who are pushing to get better each year. It's working. Jeff. While all this thanking seems over the top, there's a strong scientific support that it ignites cooperative behavior. In a study by Adam Grant and Francesco Gino, subjects were asked to help a fictitious student named Eric write a cover letter for a job application. After helping him, half of the participants received a thankful response from Eric. Half received a neutral response. The subjects then received a request for help from Steve, a different student. Those who had received thanks from Eric chose to help Steve more than twice as often as those who had received the neutral response. In other words, a small thank you caused people to behave far more generously to a completely different person. This is because thank yous aren't only expressions of gratitude. They're crucial belonging cues that generate a contagious sense of safety, connection, and motivation. In my research, I sometimes saw the most powerful person in a group publicly express gratitude for one of the group's least powerful members. For example, the chef Thomas Keller, who runs French Laundry, Per Se, and other world-class restaurants, has a habit of thanking the dishwasher at his restaurant openings, highlighting the fact that the performance of the restaurant depends on the person who performs the humblest task. Urban Meyer, who coached Ohio State football to a national championship in 2015, used this same method at the team's post-title celebration at Ohio Stadium, which was attended by tens of thousands of students and fans. Everyone presumed he would begin the celebration by introducing the star players who had led the team to success. Instead, Meyer introduced an unheralded player named Nick Sayrak, a reserve defensive back who, at the beginning of the season, had voluntarily given up his scholarship so that Meyer could give it to a player who could help the team more. Meyer spotlighted Sayrak for the same reason Keller spotlighted the dishwashers. Here is the unheralded person who makes our success possible. Be painstaking in the hiring process. Deciding who's in and who's out is the most powerful signal any group sends, and successful groups approach their hiring accordingly. Most have built lengthy, demanding processes that seek to assess fit, contribution, through deep background research and extensive interactions with a large number of people in the group, and performance, increasingly measured by tests. Some groups, like Zappos, have added an extra layer of belonging cues. After training is complete, they offer trainees a $2,000 bonus if they quit. About 10% of trainees accept the offer. Eliminate bad apples. The groups I studied had extremely low tolerance for bad apple behavior and, perhaps more important, were skilled at naming those behaviors. The leaders of the New Zealand All Blacks, the rugby squad that ranks as one of the most successful teams on the planet, achieve this through a rule that simply states, "No dickheads." It's simple, and that's why it's effective. Create safe, collision-rich spaces. The groups I visited were uniformly obsessed with design as a lever for cohesion and interaction. I saw it in Pixar's Steve Jobs-designed atrium, and in the U.S. Navy SEAL Team 6's expansive team rooms, which resemble hotel conference areas, albeit filled with extremely fit men with guns. I also saw it in smaller, simpler levers like coffee machines. A few years back, Bank of America was struggling with burnout in its call center teams. They brought in Ben Waber to do a sociometric analysis, which found that workers were highly stressed and that the best reliever of that stress was time spent together away from their desks. Waber recommended aligning team members' schedules so they shared the same 15-minute coffee break every day. He also had the company buy nicer coffee machines and install them in more convenient gathering places. The effect was immediate. A 20% increase in productivity and a reduction in turnover from 40% to 12%. Weber has also overseen interventions in company cafeterias. Merely replacing 4-person tables with 10-person tables has boosted productivity by 10%. The lesson of all these studies is the same. Create spaces that maximize collisions. "We used to hire out our food service to a contractor," said Ed Catmull, president and co-founder of Pixar, of whom we'll hear more in Chapter 16. "We didn't consider making food to be our core business. But when you hire it out, that food service company wants to make money. And the only way they can make money is to decrease the quality of the food or the service. They're not bad or greedy people. It's a structural problem. That's why we decided to take it over ourselves and give our people high-quality food at a reasonable price. Now we have really good food and people stay here instead of leaving. And they have the kind of conversations and encounters that help our business. It's pretty simple. We realized that food really is part of our core business." Make sure everyone has a voice. Ensuring that everyone has a voice is easy to talk about, but hard to accomplish. This is why many successful groups use simple mechanisms that encourage, spotlight, and value full group contribution. For example, many groups follow the rule that no meeting can end without everyone sharing something. My favorite method is Toyota's use of the Andon, a cord that any employee can use to stop the assembly line when they spot a problem. Like many organizational habits that ensure voice, this one seems inefficient at first, overturning the hierarchy by allowing a lowly assembly line worker to stop the entire company. But a closer look shows that it creates belonging by placing power and trust in the hands of the people doing the work. Others hold regular reviews of recent work in which anybody can offer their 2 cents. Pixar calls them dailies, all-inclusive morning meetings where everybody gets the chance to offer input and feedback on recently created footage. Others establish regular forums where anyone can bring an issue or question before the group's leaders, no matter how controversial it might be. But no matter how strong the rule, the underlying key is to have leaders who seek out connection and make sure voices are heard. A good example is the method of Michael Abrashoff, a Navy captain who took command of the destroyer USS Benfold in 1997. At the time, the Benfold ranked at the bottom of the Navy's performance scores. One of his first acts was to hold one-on-ones with each of the ship's 310 sailors for 30 minutes. Completing all the meetings took about 6 weeks. Abrashoff asked each sailor 3 questions. 1. What do you like most about the Benfold? 2. What do you like least? 3. What would you change if you were captain? Whenever Abrashoff received a suggestion he felt was immediately implementable, he announced the change over the ship's intercom, giving credit to the idea's originator. Over the next 3 years, on the strength of this and other measures, which are detailed in Abrashoff's book, It's Your Ship, the Benfold rose to become one of the Navy's highest-ranked ships. Pick up trash. Back in the mid-1960s, UCLA's men's basketball team was in the midst of one of the most successful eras in sports history, winning 10 titles in 12 years. Franklin Adler, the team's student manager, saw something odd. John Wooden, the team's legendary head coach, was picking up trash in the locker room. "Here was a man who had already won 3 national championships, Adler said. A man who was already enshrined in the Hall of Fame as a player, a man who had created and was in the middle of a dynasty, bending down and picking up scraps from the locker room floor. Wooden was not alone. Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, was famous for picking up trash. Every night you'd see him coming down the street, walking close to the gutter, picking up every McDonald's wrapper and cup along the way, former McDonald's CEO Fred Turner told author Alan Deutschman. He'd come into the store with both hands full of cups and wrappers. I saw Ray spend one Saturday morning with a toothbrush cleaning out holes in the mop wringer. No one else really paid attention to the damned mop wringer, because everyone knew it was just a mop bucket. But Kroc saw all the crud building up in the holes, and he wanted to clean them so the wringer would work better. I kept seeing that pattern. Coach Billy Donovan of the University of Florida, now with the Oklahoma City Thunder, cleaned up Gatorade that had spilled on the floor. Mike Krzyzewski of Duke and Tom Coughlin of the New York Giants did the same. The leaders of the All Blacks rugby team have formalized this habit into a team value called sweeping the sheds. Their leaders do the menial work, cleaning and tidying the locker rooms, and along the way, vividly model the team's ethic of togetherness and teamwork. This is what I would call a muscular humility, a mindset of seeking simple ways to serve the group. Picking up trash is one example, but the same kinds of behaviors exist around allocating parking places. Egalitarian, with no special spots reserved for leaders. Picking up checks at meals. The leaders do it every time. And providing for equity in salaries, particularly for startups. These actions are powerful not just because they are moral or generous, but also because they send a larger signal. We are all in this together. Capitalize on threshold moments. When we enter a new group, our brains decide quickly whether to connect. So successful cultures treat these threshold moments as more important than any other. For example, suppose you are hired at Pixar, whether it's as a director or as a barista in the company cafe. On your first day, you and a small group of fellow newbies are ushered into the theater where screenings are held. You are asked to sit in the fifth row, because that's where the directors sit. Then you hear the following words. Whatever you were before, you are a filmmaker now. We need you to help us make our films better. Samantha Wilson, who was originally hired by Pixar as a barista for the company cafe, is now a story manager for the studio, having worked on Inside Out, Up, and Cars 2. It's incredibly powerful, said Mike Sundy, who works in data management. You feel changed. The Oklahoma City Thunder, a successful NBA team, makes similar use of their first day. Oklahoma City is an unlikely place for a professional sports franchise. It is relatively small and isolated, known more for tornadoes than for nightlife. When you are hired by the Thunder, either as a player or as an employee, the first thing that happens is that you are taken to the Oklahoma City National Memorial, which honors the victims of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. You walk around the reflecting pool. You see the sculpture of 168 chairs, one for each victim. The general manager, Sam Presti, often leads the tour. He doesn't say much. He simply lets you walk around and feel the solemnity of the place. Then, toward the end, he reminds players to look into the stands during games and to remember that many of those people were personally affected by this tragedy. It's a small moment, but it makes a big difference for the same reason the Wipro experiment made a difference. It sends a powerful belonging cue at the precise moment when people are ripest to receive it. Of course, threshold moments don't only happen on day one. They happen every day. But the successful groups I visited paid attention to moments of arrival. They would pause, take time, and acknowledge the presence of the new person, marking the moment as special. We are together now. Avoid giving sandwich feedback. In many organizations, leaders tend to deliver feedback using the traditional sandwich method. You talk about a positive, then address an area that needs improvement, then finish with a positive. This makes sense in theory, but in practice, it often leads to confusion, as people tend to focus either entirely on the positive or entirely on the negative. In the cultures I visited, I didn't see many feedback sandwiches. Instead, I saw them separate the two into different processes. They handled negatives through dialogue, first by asking if a person wants feedback, then having a learning-focused two-way conversation about the needed growth. They handled positives through ultra-clear bursts of recognition and praise. The leaders I spent time with shared a capacity for radiating delight when they spotted behavior worth praising. These moments of warm, authentic happiness functioned as magnetic north, creating clarity, boosting belonging, and orienting future action. Embrace fun. This obvious one is still worth mentioning, because laughter is not just laughter. It's the most fundamental sign of safety and connection.